individuation. Why do people attach so much meaning to this concept? Perhaps because it gives us hope and belief that we can improve and change. Or maybe because it hints to us that there is a mysterious plan we can follow. A plan given to us by Carl Gustav Jung. A set of tools which will help us escape this shameful, rotten, not good enough version of ourselves that we are and lead us towards something more complete and whole and at peace with ourselves. And so today I'm going to talk to you about some of the glories and pitfalls of this individuation process and how it clashes with neuroscience. So what is the meaning of this individuation concept that people sling around like a hot potato of divine God power energy? Why is it charged with so much meaning? Why do people dribble at the mountain and say, one day I'll achieve individuation and it will all be better. All the bad things will go away. What is this abstract concept? Shall we sling this abstract concept up onto stage and shall we beat it and torture it like Mel Gibson at the end of Braveheart? Shall we stick knives in it? Shall we pull it apart until we see what it's really made of? Is its spirit real or is it just a faker? Will it cry out mercy or will it scream individuation? What will really happen? And so today we're going to dive into that. We're going to take a look, and I'm going to begin by, of course, unpacking this jargon, and I'm going to start by showing you where I was when I first came across this, because I, as a young man at the end of college, I was in a state of an immense shame and depression and self-hate. I thought that I was not good enough and I wanted to transform. Now the crushing feeling of this, because this is quite a normal place to be. You have low status, you don't have any assets, and you don't feel good enough, and you want to change, you want to become something else, you want to become high status, juicy, you want to become better. But of course, the thing that terrified me the most is that I was fixed, I was stiff, I was stuck in the form that I was. I could not change. I am not good enough, and I can't become good enough. There is no way. And so I'd sit there and I'd stew in this feeling, because I could, like, it was going to be so long before I became better. And I'd stew in these feelings and I'd stew with these ideas that my dad failed me and he could have prepared me better. Instead, I've been kicked off the top of the cliff and fallen down and tried to flap my little boyo wings. But of course, I didn't do it on time and I hit the rocks and now I'm broken. There was all this resentment towards this whole development system known as the family and the education system that I came from. It was incompetent. There was no Ubermensch coming out of these institutions at all. It was disgusting. I had no speech skills. I was broke. I was unhappy. I was not cool. I was not cultured, and I had no style, and I had a chip on my shoulder because of all this. And most importantly, and at root of it all, was I was in anguish because I couldn't manifest my dreams. And what does that mean? I could sit there in my room with all this lack, not having any of these skills, feeling like, you know, I had 20 years to develop all this stuff, but it had all been wasted. No one had ever taken a serious, there was no serious people around to actually develop me. I felt like I had all this potential. And I could see in my mind all these cool things that I could be. I could get really good at music. I could get really good at storytelling. I could get really good at speaking. I could get really good at social skills. I could get really juicy and chad. I could become like Tyler Durden. But these were all dreams in my mind, and I didn't have the potency in my hands and in my reality to make these things manifest. I couldn't do it. I couldn't create these things that I was seeing and I wanted to. And of course, there had to be a way that I could go about this. Is it training? What do I do? Do I do what all my friends are doing? Do I just sort of float around statically and just do, you could say, degrading behavior, such as maybe drinking and partying? And then all these people, part of this life I was living, who told me, yeah, that's the way you should live. And it's like, oh, don't take yourself too serious. Learn to relax more, or something like that. And I'm like, no, I don't want to relax. I don't want to be happy. I don't want that. I want to transform. I want to go Phoenix mode. And it was this is what caused me to become an improver. And so I'd been very lucky to have a very, very good English teacher, and he had cultured me quite a lot, despite my resentment. There's always a silver lining. And so there was an English teacher who cultured me a lot and taught me an immense amount about literature. And this, of course, got me into Nietzsche and Jung eventually. I was well into Shakespeare, eventually got into Nietzsche and Jung. And I discovered Jung's concepts and Nietzsche's concepts of this idea of improvement and collective improvement and this idea of the Übermensch. We could all become the Tyler Durden within, and all of society, like this is sort of what Nietzsche says, all of society is in the same place that I am. It's fallen. It's not good enough. It's arrogant. And what it needs to do is it needs to go through a path of transformation and become an Uber society, an Übermensch, a society worthy of creating an Übermensch. And I come across this idea of individuation, and I start to go, I even go into the self-help realm of things, and I start to gather all these things that I could try to do, all these things that would help me transform, these rituals of transformation. I start to hunt them out obsessively. And so my improvement begins with the two hands of victory, the two firm hands of victory, the body, the mastery of the body, and the mastery of the mind. And I begin a variety of different trainings. I go out and I'm broke as fuck at this point, but I go out and I spend what little money I have, I spend it on learning to fight. I want to learn how to punch people. And so I want to test myself. I want to feel, see what it feels like to get punched. I go and I go to the gym and I lift weights. I want to feel what it's like to be able to pull up your body 10 times, you know? I go and I work on my social skills. I go out and I talk to new people. It's so scary. And I'm like, oh, hello. You see girls. You're like, oh, shit, girls. Hi, girl. What's up? How are you? Oh, my God. You're a girl. What the fuck? I'm improving. And then I would do mental training. I experimented with meditation, with visualization. And of course, I went training and I got like mentors, for example, to teach me music and whatnot. I did all these things. I tried all these things and it was immensely fun. It was kind of strange. It's like, this was brilliant. I wanted to live my life this way. This is work. This is like the best thing ever. I would do this all day. Some people would say this is effort. It's like, I would do this all day, every day if I could. But of course, I didn't have the wealth to back it up. And that was a big problem. So I slowly had to like figure out how to make my money and whatnot. And all of these aspects led to a huge change in my character, a huge change in my skill level, my personality, everything. I became a lot happier and more competent. It was a brilliant, brilliant time. Even though I was so broke, it was a brilliant, brilliant time because it set me on the upward spiral. I built some habits that gave me momentum that has lasted well into my current day right now. But the biggest urge within me was to achieve creative genius. I looked at people like Elon Musk. I looked at people like Dante. I looked at the people like Friedrich Nietzsche. And I always wanted to have what they have, which is this ability to produce something original and creative. And it's such a good and potent urge inside a young man. There's this desire to challenge myself, to better myself, to destroy my past self and manifest out of me something that is creative and beautiful and a productive gift to society. Literally, that was my urge. I didn't want to do anything other than just make something, almost tyrannically craft something that fills people with joy and inspiration and brings more beauty into the world. And I saw I couldn't do this. I felt impotent and sterile. And I saw in these people who had this, what they have is they have this dreaming mind. They have this very, very visionary mind. They have this special mind. Elon Musk thinking like, I can take people to the stars. I don't care at all. He's like all this vision and all this ability to achieve things. Nietzsche with his dazzling way of writing and whatnot. And I sitting there lacking my potential, I'm sort of angry. I'm like, I don't have this. I can't create anything. I'm trying to make stuff and it's just not coming out right. I try to draw to test myself. Say, do I have this visionary mind? I'll try to draw. And this is what used to happen to me. I would stencil out other drawings that look nice and color them in my own way. I couldn't produce my own stuff. I would try to make symbols and all this, but it would all just be me putting together other things, collecting all this stuff, a left brain lost in its path. And I could not do it and I felt impotent. And I was starting to get very, very resentful about this because I wanted to be like this, but I couldn't do it. And I was starting to hear these horrible, horrible stories that the mind is fixed. Once you hit adulthood, that's it. Your mind is fixed. And the time for you to become a genius, to become different, to become exceptional, the time for you to fulfill your potential was during your childhood. Mozart was a kid. He was a childhood prodigy. All of these guys were childhood prodigies. And you're never going to be anything if you weren't something when you're a kid. And this starts to make me furious because this takes the power out of my hands. And it says to me that the people who are in charge, the responsibility for your potential was in the hands of those people in charge when you were younger. You know, the family, society, and the education system. All those people who told you to shut up and sit down and do what they tell you. Those people who told you to be quiet and take in the information and don't think and don't try be yourself. Don't try draw outside the lines. Don't color in during this special class of jargon. No, what I want you to do is I want you to do my agenda. And this is for your benefit. This will make you the best. And then you go through it. You eventually buck to it. You bow to it because it's enforced so hard, and your mind dies off and you become a jargonite and everything goes gray. And that's precisely what happened to me. My mind died in school. When I was a kid, I had all this stuff. It died when I was in school. And then when you hit 20 years old, they pat you on the head and say, you're qualified now, you're fixed, and you're thrown out, you're pooped out of the system, thrown into it, and you've got this gray, dead mind, inanimate a body and inanimate emotions, no skills, and a head full of nonsense. And that's supposed to be some type of victory. And I'm sitting there realizing all this stuff, furious that I now cannot change anymore. They're all saying, no, it's done, it's over. Your chance, it was all to do with your development, and the people whose hands were that in us say that you can't achieve anything, so you may as well just accept your destiny. It was like some type of joke that they were playing on me, and it was my whole life. And this is what was so hard about it. The urge was so good in me. That's all I wanted to do, was make something great, and knowing gave a crap. No one cared. No one wanted that. They had just shoved me through the system, and if I didn't come out right, it was like, you're a failure, whatever. And so I was depressed. But of course, this was not a destiny affirmed or restrictive. Jung proposed that there's a different way of thinking that you could achieve. Such a crazy idea that this grayscale way of thinking could be actually challenged. Adulthood development could happen. You could call it individuation. This is something that happens throughout the whole course of your life. It's like, what? It's like, so I could actually change past this magical age of adulthood when they kick you out of school, when everything's stuck. You can actually change your destiny still. And that fascinated me. And I was open to anything at this point. And so I went for it. I said, all right, I'll go Bruce Lee mode in this Swiss guy, this Carl Gustavus Jung. I dropped what is useless. I ignored all the theory. I was like, oh, the hell with Carl. I've heard enough theory for a lifetime at this point. What can I do to get this other way of thinking, to make this individuation thing happen if it's so good? How do I make this stuff happen? And Jung would say, well, you know, if you individuate, if you talk to your unconscious, if you talk to the dreams, you'll find that that's where all the visionary stuff comes from. That's the colorful part of your mind. Like, your dreams are very colorful. And I'm like, oh, yes, it's also very simple. So I sit down and I read my dreams for an extended period of time. And I am astounded at the results. You see, just before this, I was trying anything. So I took a very, very high dose of psychedelics to try unleash my creativity upon the world. And it worked. If you listen to my video on the Red Book, there's a poem at the start of it. And that was an example of something that flashed out of me, a really unique experience for me, where I'm sitting down and I don't really want to write anything. I'm not forcing myself to write anything, but something came out of me and I just scribble out this poem. And I draw pictures alongside of it. And it's like, oh my God, this stuff is coming to me, and I'm not stenciling anything else. There's this different, it was almost like a light or a fire was switched on inside my mind, a fire of dreaming color, a different way of thinking, not active thinking, but almost like I was receiving something from the unconscious, from the other side. So we do this dream reading thing, because after a while that psychedelic thing fades and I'm a bit depressed again because I'm stuck in grayscale mode, being like, oh, I'll have to take psychedelics every day in order to achieve this. But what happens is I do this dream reading stuff, and it's like a slow turning up of the dial, where suddenly all the time there's this permanent, it's like the flame starts off like a little candle and it's slowly getting stronger, and then it's just burning nice and brightly all the time. A nice stable controlled flame instead of an explosion, a stable controlled flame. And suddenly I'm having the problem where I have too many ideas. Suddenly my mind has literally changed and this creativity is turned on. Something has happened that is significant, absolutely astounding me, showing that my mind is better. And I have now got this problem where all this stuff is erupting out. I'm going to have to spend the next couple of years crafting what these dreams are pouring out into something higher, into some type of creative thing. And so I conclude that this Jungian proposition, when I actually did it instead of reading about it, did something to my mind. And let's talk about the neuroscience of what that might be. But first of all, we have to look at what Jung meant by this individuation process and why he was so heavy on stuff like dream reading. Like, what was this individuation process supposed to achieve? This gentleman, Scott Jeffrey, it's one of the first Google results on this. I just went for a very simple definition because let's talk about simple things. Dreams, Jung found, are the gateway through which the unconscious communicates with our conscious mind. Interesting. Our inner wise old man or woman, quote unquote, the self, knows what's best for us. This self, however, cannot communicate in language. Instead, it uses symbols and images. The self cannot communicate directly with our conscious mind. Instead, according to Jungian psychology, it sends us messages through our dreams. And so this presents to us this idea that this quote unquote self is alive and can guide us. And that's strange, because this is where people read Jung and say this is woo-woo Jungian nonsense. And of course you speak to a lot of Jungians and it's like they're throwing at you like self-wise old man and all this stuff. And you're like, this sounds like a cult. Sounds like a cult. I don't really want to be part of this. And I get it. And it feels like these people are owned by the words. They do not own the words. But of course we have the opportunity to de-jargonize things and own these words, because it seems like this could just be nonsense. I understand why people are skeptical, but there's something about your mind that suggests that we should inspect this a little bit more. Check this out.
Your brain is two brains, two hemispheres, each doing half the work of being you. Half your vision goes to each and half your movement directed by each. Right controls left and left controls right. Your two brains coordinate through a wire of nerves, but this wire can be cut and was, for a time, used as an epilepsy treatment. After the cut, people seemed the same, though their brain was split in twain. Except some post-split patients describe that while selecting their morning outfit with right hand, left might come along to disagree. Actually, left hand might quite often disagree, which these split brain patients found frustrating. What's happening? To investigate, remember, right brain sees and controls one half, while left brain controls and sees the other. But only left brain can speak.
Hello.
Because that's where the speech center is located. Right brain, without this, is mute. In normal brains, this doesn't matter because each half communicates across the wire with
the other. That's
crazy. But split brains can't, and thus you can show just the right brain a word, ask the person, what did you see, and you'll hear
nothing.
Because left-speaking brain saw nothing. Meanwhile, right brain will use its hand to pick the object out of a pile hidden from left brain. This is deeply creepy. Ask, why are you holding the object, and speaking left brain will make up a plausible sounding but totally wrong reason.
I always wanted to learn how to solve one of these.
Left brain isn't lying, it's just doing what brains do, creating a story that explains its past actions to its current self, a behavior which does rather cast doubt onto the notion of free will, but that's a story for another time. Creating reasons for why it does things is just something left brains do. It happens in normal, healthy humans all the time, and if you think about it closely, you know you've done this. Back to experiments. Give right brain an object, ask the person what's in your hand, and they won't be able to say.
I'm not holding anything.
And when asked to draw, a split brain can draw two separate objects simultaneously with each hand in a way unsplit brains find challenging. These experiments on split brain patients are deeply unsettling because they really point in the direction of a mute, separate, intelligent something living in the skull. You can even
boom, 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 boom. Wait a second. What? Wait a second. Wait a second. Wait a second. So this is pretty solid. This is pretty solid neuroscience, some of the most solid neuroscience you're ever going to come across. And when people look at this stuff, it's so far outside of our paradigm, but it looks like it's real. You have this right brain that, what was that again? That right brain that cannot communicate directly with our conscious mind. Instead, according to Jungian psychology, it sends us messages to our dreams. This other brain, which cannot communicate in language, instead uses symbols and images. This is actually the right brain. It sits there mute because the Broca's areas is over here, and it does stuff, and it's there with us all the time during the day, and it's unconscious. This sounds an awful lot like what's going on here. Now the most important thing is that it's a separate intelligence. It's a separate personality inside your head. Now that's weird. That's kind of crazy when you think, when you kind of let that kind of sit with you right now. Me and you are having a chat. Even me, I'm talking here. There's another thing that's like not me. It has a different personality, but it's inside my head beside me in the other half of the room. And it knows that I'm sort of becoming metacognate of its existence, and it's sort of snickering to itself. And it's here all the time and it's working with me. What is that thing doing there? What does it want? How does it, what's going on? That's crazy. But that looks an awful lot like what Jung is saying, that there's this entity inside your psychology, your mind, which is alive and can guide you. Now we might have to jungle Jung around a little bit, but let's go with the evidence and try to give Jung a bit of a hand here. Now, scary stuff, weird stuff, but again, it just keeps on showing up more and more. For example, dreams and the right brain. Therefore, due to the lateralized remembrance of dreams, the left hemisphere of the brain must access the memories of the right brain when a person is asked to describe a dream or even to remember it. To access the memory banks of the right hemisphere, the left brain must use the corpus callosum or anterior commissure. The left hemisphere of the brain is involved primarily in encoding and recalling verbal, temporal, sequential, and language-related memories, blah, 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 blah. So as a result, dream interpretation becomes very difficult due to the fact that the left hemisphere is forced to interpret what the right brain has created using a language the left brain does not understand. That makes perfect sense, because when I read my dreams for an extended period of time, that's what I started to notice, is that as I would dump my dreams and then I would go back to them later and read through them and try to figure them out. And it was kind of weird and difficult, but what would happen is these things would flush out. I would completely forget the dream and go about my day. I would completely not remember what it was. I'd have this crazy dream and just like 20 minutes later, not remember what it was. And I go back and look at it. And as I was reading through it, all this stuff would rush up from my unconscious that I'd literally forgotten from the start of the day. And it would be all this vivid and colorful things. And what was I doing? Like this thing that worked for me. It was so strange because I wasn't really sure what I was doing, but I was just running with what Jung said, actually doing it as opposed to, you know, talking about the theory. And it got such massive results for me. And the thing was that I was probably sitting down and doing a procedure that got my two hemispheres to talk to each other. It forced my left brain to go to the dream contents, which bullied me into my right brain, which made me a visual thinker, which made me get back in touch with that hemisphere and get the two of them working together. I trained my brains, two sides of my brains, my unconscious mind, my right brain and left brain, to talk to each other. And therefore, it got these brilliant, brilliant results. And of course, that makes quite a lot of sense. And then, as I'm saying, the science shows that we store dreams in our right brain. Famously, you can't read during when you're dreaming. When you're lucid dreaming, one of the tells that you're lucid dreaming, one of the things that you do, if you want to train yourself to lucid dream, you need to do these reality checks. So you walk into a room, you click on the light, and you also try read stuff. You're just like, can I read that? In lucid dreaming, when you're dreaming, you can't read because everything kind of comes up as vague dribbles. Of course, the right brain cannot read. It's not good with language in that way. So this is a very, very strange thing. I'm going to give you some more lab coat speak here about this stuff. Most dreaming occurs during REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep. REM has been found to be associated with brainstem arousal and right hemisphere activation and low-level left hemisphere arousal. And this was by a gentleman called Mayer, Goldstein, and Hobada, whoever that is. Based on extensive review of scientific studies, the overwhelming evidence indicates that whereas the brainstem activates the right hemisphere during dream sleep and is thus physiologically responsible for REM, the eye movements being mediated by brainstem cranial nerves, so the bottom of your brain creates REM sleep, the dream contents have the source in memories and impressions stored within the right half of the brain, which is crazy. However, the right hemisphere is not only dreams in the dream. The left hemisphere, being at a low level of arousal, passively observes. The right hemisphere stores the dream in the right hemisphere memory afterwards as well. So we're now starting to get to a point. And this is nuts. We're starting to get to a point where your corpus callosum is like this little door, okay, between these two hemisphere. So you're walking around and you've got your ego, your left brain, and you're walking around your day doing your stuff. And in your corpus callosum, this is the only place that you connect these two. Like they said in the video, you can cut that and the two hemispheres don't talk to each other anymore. So this is the link, the little door to Narnia in the middle. And then the other side, you've got this entire other dude or girl or thing, entity, personality living on the other side of your head that makes different decisions about things all the time. And it stores all your dreams. So it's got this vivid, crazy Narnia world. It's got this vivid, crazy, like monster under your bed world. It's got this other world living there. And when you dream, that door opens and then it starts to talk. It talks to the left brain, the ego, being like, yo, I'm still here. Do you want a story? It's like Hollywood time. And it starts painting you some crazy, ridiculous picture. It starts to communicate with you with the symbols because it can't talk with that. And as member Jordan Peterson said, the Jung believed that the dreams are trying to tell you something, but they weren't able to do it. Jung was very on point with that. And so it's, and then it brings all that stuff back in when you wake up. It sucks it all out and it brings it back in. And it has all this stuff it's trying to tell you. So it's almost like a sort of wife or a coach, you know, like it's seeing everything you do, and it's a wife with no mouth. So it sees everything you do and it sees all the mistakes you're doing and all your pains and whatnot. And then when you go to sleep, it tries to send you the right images and the right stories to kind of keep you hyped and motivated up. That's amazing. And that literally looks like what's happening. So this is very strange stuff. This is very strange stuff, because then we have to ask the question, well, when Jung says individuation, what the hell is he talking about? Because he says you want to get this other entity on the side of your head that lives in Narnia, the owner of Narnia land. You want to get them working with you, which actually makes sense. You get the right brain, the left brain working together. So the process of individuation, as I would propose, is the right brain presenting itself to you and slowly getting to know you. Now, why does this happen this way? Well, you'll actually be surprised to know that as a child, most children are right side dominant when they're born. So they're born very, you know, the way kids walk around, they're like they're on drugs. Actually, well, they sort of are. They're completely in their right brain. That's why they're very formless. They're not really, you know, not really put together in some sense. Now, until the age of 3, blood flow is significantly greater to the right hemisphere of the brain. Between the ages of 4 and 7, there is a huge shift as the left half of the brain typically takes over and comes online. This aligns with most countries of the world delaying formal education until 7 years of age. Interesting. Do you remember kindergarten when they would like get you to like juggle bricks and like draw trains and stuff like that? And then when you hit about 5 or 7, they're like, all right, go into and become a jargonite in crappy school. And even like the start of school in Ireland, the first 2 years are basically like, you know, they're kind of like bullshit class. Like, you know, you throw paint on each other and stuff like this. But then around about, you know, grade 1 or 7, they're sort of like, all right, time to get boring, time to destroy your mind. And then they go and just like slam your head into these long worded silly books and whatnot. You'll notice, you look at the early classrooms are like colorful alphabets and stuff like that, but then slowly the classrooms start to get more dull and dead and boring. Interesting stuff. Also, speech matures around about 7. By age 4, your child's thoughts should start to flow in complete sentences with far less effort than it took just a year earlier. So this is the left brain coming online, the master of speech. By age 7, you essentially can talk properly, completely, with sophistication, you know? At this point, your child usually shouldn't have to stop and think about what they say or how to say it. But before that, they're sort of like a drunk, little drunk, being like, what's going on? Babble, babble, babble. Like, what's going on? They're trying to do what the left brain does, which is accurate and put stuff together. So as a child, you had this more blood in this side of your brain, and it was maybe working more powerful, and this part of your brain was experiencing life. And so you were sort of living maybe through your right brain. Maybe it was more conscious. It's hard to know. But then, of course, the left brain comes online, the ego comes online, it consolidates, and then boom, you're sort of there. You're like, hello, I'm a person. And then this right brain goes to become unconscious. It's not really there with you anymore. But of course, the whole way through your life, it's sitting in the other side of your head. It's there with you. It's there beside you. It's helping you out. But it's unconscious. It's quiet. It's passive. And so you can live your whole life unconscious of this right side. And the mature process of individuation is the return, the trad return to building a relationship back with this right brain, to sort of turn around and be like, hey, I forgot about you. You were here at the very start, and then now you're gone. And what? That's so strange. Hello. And then what the right brain does is, of course, it says, yes, you're back. Here's all the crap that I've been picking up over the years. Here you go. Here's the shadow. And you're like, oh, my God, what happened? And even think about this in a serious sense, like people who go through childhood trauma. Maybe that's what happens. It gets stored in the right brain, put deep, because think about the dreams. You wake up and you don't remember your dream. You forget your dream. But then when you read the dream you wrote down in that daze, it all comes flooding back. And it's kind of shocking. You're like, whoa, where did that come from? I don't remember that at all. It's almost like your left brain didn't experience it, but it's there. And so is that sort of what happens with things like trauma and all this? You can go years without experiencing that stuff. You do this active process. You let the contents of the unconscious come rushing out. And it's so interesting Jung chose those words, because that sounds right. The contents of the right brain come rushing out. And then you try to integrate all that. And of course, Jung is adamant in his suggestion that autonomous figures will appear to you that try to work with you. It's like, what? What do you mean? What do you want about Carol, you mad bastard? So you'll start reading your dreams and there'll be things in your dreams that are alive. And this is where he loses a lot of people. It's like, dude, like what, your dreams have contain separate entities that are living. Bro, get out of here. Like, and then, as I said, the Jungians come in and be like, no, man, like, you know, you got to join the cult. But of course, when you look at the evidence, it seems like Carol was onto something, because the right brain is a living separate personality, as the science shows, and it tries to present itself to you somehow. And it can present itself, it can walk up and shake your hand and be like, hello, I am the right brain. It lives inside your head, it's a big lump of blob inside your head, right? And so the way it shows itself to you is through imagistic stories. And so it almost needs to personify as something. It needs to appear as something. So what it does, and this is the process of individuation, is that it shows itself to you in various stages. Because at first, your right brain, maybe because it's carrying all that trauma, will have to show itself as something kind of dark and scary. That's the shadow. That's the first step. So let's talk about that for a bit. Jung, for example, as he went through this, noticed that the main character of the individuation process appeared in different forms. It began as the shadow, then it appears as his anima, the Salme, I think he called it, and then Philemon, which is the wise old man, the self. And we're going to talk about that, because the right brain has to show itself to you, but maybe you have to rebuild this relationship, and maybe the right brain's aware, or maybe it takes a while for you to realize, like, you know, you're kind of like not sure about this. It takes a while for you to upgrade the levels till you get to this final point where you've unified all this stuff together. So let's talk about the concept of the shadow first. Like, why is it the shadow where we all always start? And of course, we're going to go to a gentleman called Jordan B. Peterson.
Okay, right hemisphere, operation in unexplored territory, negative emotion, inhibition of behavior. That's this, that's anxiety. That's what happens when the Medusa looks at you. You turn to stone, right? That's the basilisk in Harry Potter. It freezes you. Why? You're moving forward according to a schema. If you're moving forward properly, you're getting to where you want to go, and the schema is being validated simultaneously. I'm moving forward and the map is correct. Something happens that's unexpected. What should you do? Stop. What else are you going to do? You stop first. Then the predator can't see you, right? That's the freezing reaction of a prey animal. So it's built very, very deeply into you. Very, very old circuits do that. In fact, if it's a real orienting reflex to something that's anomalous, you'll go like this. And that's to stop the thing that will jump on your back from tearing out your throat. And that's really, really fast. It's almost as fast as spinal snake reflex circuitry. Extraordinarily fast. And that's conserved over an evolutionary span. That predator defense system is at the bottom of your cognitive apparatus. Everything's been built on that. Like, it's a low resolution pattern. A higher resolution pattern that's the same pattern is built on top of that. Then a higher resolution pattern that's the same pattern is built on top of that, and so on. But that initial architecture is duplicated across the levels of differentiation of the nervous system. And that's partly why these symbols can be so archaic and still be accurate. It's still the way the world works. Negative emotion, inhibition of behavior, image processing. Right, because thing about images is they're fast. You know, a picture is worth 1,000 words. Okay, you get the picture. You know, get the picture is actually something you say to someone if you say, do you understand? Right, to get the picture is very, very fast. So the right hemisphere manages that. Holistic thinking, that's that low resolution thinking that generalizes across instances. Pattern recognition, pattern generation, and gross motor action. Yeah, freeze and get the hell out of there. That's gross motor action. The right hemisphere is very good at that. That's why if you're right-handed, you use your left hemisphere to manage the really fine motor details, right? You write with it. And because that's very, very, if you're right-handed, you tend to use your left hand to open the top of jars, right? You use your left hand. That's a gross motor action. I mean, sometimes people are more lateralized than that. But the left hemisphere is specialized for the fine-grained things that you know very well. That's exactly it. Okay, the left hemisphere. Well, the left hemisphere, which is associated with positive emotion, by the way, that's specialized for operation in explored territory. So now what we might say is that you spend your whole life trying not to have your right hemisphere turn on.
Big idea.
Because why would you want that? That's where the monsters pop up. So you stay in explored territory, but maybe you also tentatively expand its borders, and the left hemisphere seems to be involved in that too. So if you're curious about something, it's usually something minor enough so that it won't blow your entire category structure if you explore it. Now, sometimes you get unlucky, and you're like Eve in the Garden of Eden. You go have a little chat with this little snake that seems to be of no significance whatsoever, and it feeds you something, the apple, it feeds you something, and bang, everything falls apart, right? You collapse, and you're out there in history. You're no longer in your old paradise. So, activation of behavior. Yeah, well, that's because positive emotion is associated with movement forward. Like, if you're where you want to be and things are going well, then your behavior should be activated so that you go and get things. Now, one of the negative consequences of that is that if you're really in a good mood, really happy, you're going to be impulsive and make mistakes. You know, because you hear these dough-headed...
So there's a lot of absolutely amazing things there coming from JBP, who just lays it out, and not really in the context that I'm talking about. Like, he never really put this stuff together, perhaps the way that I'm framing it. But think about that. Your goal is to try spend your whole life trying to not have your right brain turn on. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, the right brain is packed full of anxiety receptors, packed full of those. It's fear. And precisely for the reason he's explaining from that evolutionary biologist perspective, like, it's very, very sensible, you know. You have the left brain that's supposed to keep you hyped, and it's generally like the idiotic ego, you know, you run around, you just do stuff. And it's generally trying to keep you in like a safe space. But then when you come to something dangerous, your right brain comes online, and it's, as I've said before, it's quietly just watching. But then when you go, you know, you go to the edge of the garden, the right brain comes online, fills you full of a dread, that type of thing. And so this is the shadow appearing to you. The first step is always the shadow, because the right brain is geared to the max with anxiety, with fear, with dread, with darkness, these type of things. Whereas the left brain is hyped and motivated, but of course a bit naive and dumb. It's the ego, of course. And so the step that you must do is you must go into this right brain, but of course you don't want to. This is sort of explains why this doesn't happen. You want to stay in your ego and go about your stuff in explored territory, as Jordan says. But what you need to do is actually, well, if you want to individuate, you need to actually face the anxiety. You need to face these, you need to face the dark side. As Joseph Campbell says, you need to go to the cave. And the cave that you fear to enter holds the treasure that you seek. And of course, these guys are just intuitively finding what I'm sort of trying to paint with you in an explicit way in regards to how your brain works. You've literally got like another side of your head that's geared towards seeing the world a certain way that connects you with your fear. And you need to go to that part of your head and build a relationship with it. And fear is a great place to start. And this is why it often presents itself to you as terror, as anxiety. This is how you first get to meet the right brain, usually, or at least when you're just sort of unconscious of this stuff. This is how it will appear in your life. It will be the injections of fear to try wake you up. This is something that I did at this point, and this is often what I recommend to young dudes. Like, don't get away from the theory stuff. You don't need this stuff as much as you think. But like, please stop reading books all the time. That's just left-brained jargonism making you worse, getting you more trapped. You're not only in your left brain, you're starting to build a palace of jargon around it that's becoming like a prison. But instead, I highly encourage most dudes to just go out and just face your fears, man. It's so simple, because fear shocks your right brain into coming online. You'll meet the unconscious. You'll start individuating if you just face your fears quite a lot. It's very, very simple. And then, if, for example, I hit upon the idea of reading my dreams, another very, very simple thing you can do. Very, very simple, very, very simple concept. And 100%, you can go deep into that stuff and it yields incredible results, because it gets the two sides of the hemisphere talking together. But then the question becomes, like, that's some very, very basic stuff, and I think that's very, very, that's good enough for most dudes to do for an extended period of time. I don't think you need to worry about that stuff. A lot of young stuff is geared towards people over 40 years old. Please keep that in mind. But, like, for a young dude, I know a lot of people would be young boyos and even the young girl arenos. Like, you know, you wanna understand the context of this stuff. The simple idea is you're just trying to build a relationship with this right brain, and it contains certain powers. And what happens is you first meet it, or it's there with you, and it shows up as the shadow. But then over time, as this relationship evolves, as you come to understand fear, as you face more fear, you'll start to get access to something else. And then the right brain and the left brain, maybe the wiring, God knows why this happens, but maybe the wiring gets stronger, so you have more ready access to the right brain, and you can sort of call it to come help you when you need it, like a guardian angel. You learn certain meditation techniques or exercises that will instantly get your right brain switching together, and we'll talk about this later. Like, there's plenty of evidence to show that you can train yourself to get your right brain, your left brain synchronized together at will, as opposed to unconsciously when you're running around and it only appears to you as a shadowy source of fear. And this is precisely what Jung said about the shadow, is that it's not necessarily real. It has no, like, body. It's just the sort of reflection of your ignorance, that type of thing. It's like something haunting you, because that's sort of what it is. You're the ego running around and it's just watching you, which is so strange. It's watching, and when it sees something it doesn't like, it kind of slaps you and says, be careful, that type of thing. But anyway, the anima, the right brain presents itself in a new way, as the guardian angel, as the muse, as the Greeks would have understood it. Jung experienced this as the anima. He called it the soul. And this is different, because this is giving you power now at this point. This is a different type of vibe. It's not the same as the other stuff. It's the right brain is now coming on, presenting itself as something different. It's changing its clothes. I'll do a whole video on the anima to talk about this in the context of the Red Book and some of the ways that this stuff appears. It's a very, very interesting thing. And especially when you add this right brain grounding to it, because it actually makes a lot of sense. The right brain comes online, fills you full of animating power, and it gives you the skills that the right brain has. It's almost like you've upgraded to the point where you have this stuff ready at hand. You've now got this stuff, like, you know, in your suit. It's no longer something that's you don't have access to. You're no longer stuck in the left brain's specific problems. The left brain, for example, is quite impotent, not necessarily the creative one. It's very, very orientated towards models and words, but not fertile in that type of sense. It's prone to delusion. It's prone to prone to anger over, like, stupid things, like people arguing with you and stuff like this. But of course, it's fantastic at feeling good and all these type of things. But of course, you spend a lot of time with this type of stuff, you integrate this anima, and this is such a dangerous concept. While I'll do a separate video on it, because a lot of dudes I talk to, again, they get into the Jungian cult and they start to represent their sterile and impotent relationship with women with this sort of Jungian idea of the anima. Let's look at maybe this more scientific place of looking at it and sort of say, okay, well, this seems to look like the right brain coming online and giving us these powers of perception, the powers of creativity and image thinking, all things that are very obvious when you think about it. The super processing power of that color flame, that dreaming flame that I was talking about. Of course, what does the anima possess? What does the right brain possess? Higher empathy, a supreme ability to recognize faces, something the left brain literally cannot do. Therefore, social skills. If you get relationship and social skills, the world opens up for you. It's one of the most important things of all. And this is the centerpiece of it. The intuition and feeling of guidance. And so maybe when this relationship gets strong enough, maybe the right brain will stop appearing to you as like a guy, a boyo dressed in black, an Irish man, you know, in an IRA suit, being like, you're fucking gonna die now, boyos. Instead, it starts to appear to you as a woman, a guardian angel, a muse. And maybe this is how the right brain sees herself inside your head. Again, I'll talk about this more. Maybe, as Jung proposed, the right brain in women sees itself as a male. Who knows? These things are very, very interesting when you study it. And Jung has given us some cool things to check out. But you can see where I'm going with this. And it's a very, very strange way of looking at things. But it seems like it makes sense. Then, of course, some of the later stages of this, something that doesn't come till a lot later, but it's obviously there in its seeds. But eventually you get to a point where you connect with what Jung would call the self, the organizing principle within it, because this right brain, as it's a very, very strange way of thinking about it, but it's not really a woman. It's not really a thing at all. It's not really like a living human. Like, we personify it like the way the Greeks personified the gods, but the right brain is sort of an organizing force. Like, it's a big blob of jelly, you know? It's not necessarily a person. And so the way it might present itself to us at this point might be a lot more, like at the very, very late stages, it might reveal itself finally for what it truly is. It might actually present itself as like an abstraction or a power. Or maybe it understands something about the world and it shows you the power it draws from. Maybe it's shown you God. I don't really know. But nonetheless, eventually what Jung notices is that this self appears in this end state of the individuation process, and it comes along with new powers. You know, it comes along with the highest powers. Maybe when you've finally integrated the left brain and the right brain together to a very, very high degree, something about the brain changes. And we'll talk about this in a moment. And you get what we say is the final intuitive power. Then, of course, what is the big tagline that Nietzsche and Jung often talk about is like, become who you are. You know, the whole idea of the self is become who you are. And that's you becoming your instinctive self, fulfilling your pattern. You might be a spider. You might be a dog. You might be a lion typed person. And so you may as well get back in touch with your right brain and let your right brain, let yourself give you your destiny. Don't run around like an ego and try to become Pavarotti when you're not Pavarotti. Instead, go into your right brain and let it show you what you are and let it lead. Allow it to be the leader. And this is, of course, the premise of Ian McGilchrist's idea, the master and its emissary. You need to learn that your ego is submissive. You must cuckold your left brain to your right brain. Your right brain must lead, and they work together as a team. That is the essential thing. Now, this proposition leads to some unbelievably interesting conclusions when we dive into more fascinating science. So let's check it out. I sound like Sam Harris these days.
Science.
My co-author of the book Altered Traits is a neuroscientist, Richard Davidson. He has a lab at the University of Wisconsin. It's a very large lab. He has dedicated scanners. He has about 100 people working there. And he was able to do some remarkable research where he flew Olympic-level meditators who live in Nepal or India, typically, or some in France. He flew them over to the lab and put them through a protocol in his brain scanners and did state-of-the-art tests, and the results were just astounding. We found, for example, or he found, that their brain waves are really different. Perhaps the most remarkable finding in the Olympic-level meditators has to do with what's called a gamma wave. All of us get gamma for a very short period when we solve a problem we've been grappling with. Even if it's something that's vexed us for months, we get about a half second of gamma. It's the strongest wave in the EEG spectrum. We get it when we bite into an apple or imagine biting into an apple. And for a brief period, a split second, inputs from taste, sound, smell, vision, all of that come together in that imagined bite into the apple. But that lasts very, very short period in an ordinary EEG. What was stunning was that the Olympic-level meditators, these are people who have done up to 62,000 lifetime hours of meditation, their brainwave shows gamma very strong all the time as a lasting trait, just no matter what they're doing. It's not a state effect. It's not during their meditation alone, but it's just their everyday state of mind. We actually have no idea what that means experientially. Science has never seen it before. We also find that in these Olympic-level meditators, when we ask them, for example, to do a meditation on compassion, their level of gamma jumps 700 to 800% in a few seconds. This has also never been seen by science. So we have to assume that the special state of consciousness that you see in the highest level meditators is a lot like something described in the classical meditation literature centuries ago, which is that there is a state of being which is not like our ordinary state. You know, sometimes it's called liberation, enlightenment, awake, whatever the word may be. We suspect there's really no vocabulary that captures what that might be. The people that we've talked to in this Olympic level group say it's a very spacious sense. You're wide open. You're prepared for whatever may come. We just don't know, but we do know it's quite remarkable.
So that is absolutely fascinating. Like, really think about that. The sort of claim and the big tagline is with Jung is the alchemical idea of unifying the opposites, getting, you know, everything working together, getting the shadow and the yin and the yang and all that. But think about it as simple as like unifying the brain, unifying the two sides of the brain. That would make a lot of sense. You know, that sounds like it's good. It's having the two brains divided. Maybe I haven't explained this, but the two brains are massively separate. The corpus callosum is the only way they talk. And so there's some type of opposite that goes into that. And what would that look like? And is that really accessible? Like, aren't we fixed? Aren't we stiff at the age of 20? Aren't we sort of like over once, you know, you hit 20 and that's it? Your brain has become crystallized intelligence and it's all downhill from there. But of course, there's obviously a huge amount of very traditional meditations that constantly talk about this, like that this idea that you can improve your mind. You know, Buddhism is full of it. And of course, the problem is that it's a bit Eastern, but it's not wrong. That's the most important thing. And these guys always go into neuroscientists and always blow the heads off neuroscientists. And so this specific one talks about this thing called gamma waves. Now, if you listened to my last one where I talked about the CIA doing studies into this, they came across this idea of hemisync that you could give people binaural beats and it would make their two hemispheres work together, synchronize together. Gamma waves are what do this. Gamma waves rise, they're so fast, they're the highest waves that they make our brains talk to each other. The way to understand the brain is that the brain is like a city full of music, and the way that the parts of your brain, neurons, the front and the back and all this, talk to each other is that they play songs, they play vibrations, and then everybody, they sort of, it's like a radio channel is probably the best way to think of it. You put out a radio frequency and then everybody in the city tunes into that radio frequency. And so you go around most of the day, you'll love this, you go around in beta waves, you run around with your little anxious beta waves being like, oh no, I'm such a beta, and all this type of stuff. But of course, that's the reason why you're so crap and why everybody hates you. But of course, but of course, it's possible for you to actually overcome that and change the way you work. You can change the channel if you want. Your beta waves are quite useful from time to time. It's good to get stuff done. You be a little simp and go around and do your work, but you're able to actually turn on and make a radio wave stronger, because every now and again this new radio channel comes online called gamma waves. This is your genius moment, your eureka moment. That's where you get a flash. It's almost like, you know, a stab of an orchestra or something like that. Like a really good song comes on every once in a while. It's like genius level event. And then they study this stuff, and like elite athletes and flow state, high level musicians and very, very, very high level mathematicians, all this type of stuff. There's full of gamma rays, and sometimes these people have even more than usual. And these gamma rays, one of their distinct characteristics is that they synchronize the two brains together, the two hemispheres together, whereas the beta waves keep you trapped and separate. You can't communicate cross hemispheres easily. So the gamma waves put everything together and they create sort of like a unified brain. It's like the marriage, it's the unity of opposites. This is one of the highest forms of human mental excellence. And of course, the Buddhists are able to actually create this in their mind. And what the experience they have of this, as they describe it, is spacious and in, as I would say, a state of instinct. Because what is that feeling of not having to think? You're just walking around in flow and everything's coming at you as it is. You're intuitively locked into the world and everything feels like you can deal with anything, really. Like there's a lot of space around, you've got time. You know, that's that sort of feeling of like time slowing down. People often talk about this in, for example, fighting and whatnot. When you hit flow state in the middle of a fight, it feels like everything gets a little bit slower and you're able to almost like let your body body do the work. You turn off as the driver, and it's almost like you surrender to instinct, and then everything becomes almost like more profound in some sense. And this is precisely what happens. And of course, these Buddhists, they spend 20 years studying this stuff, training their brains, not just reading theory. They don't do that. To become a Buddhist, you need to learn it. And this is a great failure of the Western people. And they actually do meditation for an extended period of time, and they turn on gamma waves permanently. They change their fucking brain. They make it different. And then it's better. They've got this hemi-sync thing semi-permanently. The opposites are unified. And now this points to something nuts. Does that say that this is actually available for us? We can completely change our brain well into adulthood, perhaps, if we just put in the work? Well, the suggestion is yes. Yes, you can. This is available to you if you want. The Buddhists have proved it consistently. And I guess what's so great about Jung is it gives you a Western slant to get into this. Psychology gives you a Western slant to get into this, but scientific psychology is a bit left-brained and stiff. But now we have something profound at our hands that we can use here. This is a big deal. This is a big deal, and I believe maybe this is a suggestion of where this quote-unquote individuation process might lead. Our questions become multiplicable. They become pretty, I'm so right-brained, I can't even talk properly. A multitude of questions pop up. And the questions are such as, well, what exercises do we do? How do we go about this? Like, for example, I got immense success from dream reading. Would that have naturally pulled me to this state of permanent gamma meditation? Maybe it would have. Who knows? If I went all the way down, would my hemis have synced, my opposites have united, and I have achieved what the Buddhists achieved just through my more Jungian direction? Or could you do it, should we go all in on meditation or something like that? These things are very, very hard to know. But there's something that we seriously have to look into. And they offer us amazing ideas. So I'm going to wrap it up like that with that. I think that's a very, very broad stroke presentation on all these type of things. But I hope that gives you a new angle on what this individuation process might be and what you should be doing. So looking through all this stuff, I've begun to see what I'm even doing now more clearly. It's very interesting to get that awareness of how unconscious you really are. I feel sometimes like a dog chasing a wheel. I don't know what I'll do when I get it. I just want it, that type of thing. Obviously, I'm always talking about doing one-on-one sessions with people. I work with people in this regard. And there's one thing where I'm not a huge fan of talk therapy. I don't want to sit there and sort of pitter-patter people's feelings and obsessively go over trauma too much and say that there's something wrong with you that you need me to fix forever. And I'll get very, very rich as I keep on feeding that money off you forever and ever and ever until the end of time while you're always broken and all this. I've always been more interested in the idea of unlocking human excellence and presenting to people ideas. I would even see it like the way a meditation teacher would sit down with someone and be like, all right, I'll teach you how to train your brain so that you achieve all these things that you're looking for permanently and you don't need me anymore. The whole idea of teaching someone to fish versus giving them fish, that type of thing, charging them for fish, if you will. And this has always been my fascination. This is really the direction I've been going into, but I wasn't really aware of what it was. And obviously recently I'm starting to see this sort of neuroscience of all this type of stuff, that the various things I do with people are geared towards this. It's like, all right, well, if you get this right brain communicating with this left brain more, you'll get access to more creativity and a more colorful mind that you're looking for. It's very, very helpful in processing emotions. This is what it's absolutely fantastic of doing. It swoops in with its colorful reimaginative version of looking at the world. And it looks at that terrible past you had and all those failures and all that trauma and all that stuff. And it rebaptizes it to a position where you can accept it, like amor fati, and let it go and just put it behind you in that regard. And so all this stuff is hugely, hugely important the more I dig into it. And I see what these guys like Jung and all them were talking about, maybe with new eyes, with a sort of modernized millennial set of eyes, or someone who like listens to too much Richard Dawkins, like myself, of course. And so if you ever really want to understand what I'm doing, because I know I don't talk about it too much, I'm building it up slowly, and at some point maybe I'll do a proper video on what I've been doing behind the scenes and all that. But if you are interested in working with me in this regard, this is sort of the broad stroke of what tends to happen. You know, I sit down with people and I show them tools and techniques, because I'm not very heavy on theory. I don't really like that stuff. I don't think it gets people results. Oh, I'll tell you about the archetypes. I'm like, no, it's not going to save you. And you're just going to fill your head with more jargon and think that's progress, and really that's just you making a tighter labyrinth around your head that's keeping you in prison. I'm much more preferable to sitting down with people and showing them, like, here's a tool you can use. You don't even need me. And this can like, you can do it forever. Like, I'll teach you how to lift weights properly in the gym, and it'll be very useful for me to do this with you. And then over the long haul, you can go and do that yourself, and you'll become like, you know, it'll just always start feeding back to you, that type of thing. And so this is really the direction I go with this stuff. Think of it in terms of when I talk about one-on-one stuff and the Boyo program and all that. Think of it me as like training, me showing you tools that I've used and I've found in my life that get you to access this right brain, to build and establish this connection between these two hemispheres in your brain, to unify the brain, to beautify the brain, to continue that development into adulthood that began when you were a child. This is an absolutely essential part of you reclaiming your humanity and achieving something of excellence and releasing your potential. And like, I'm not sort of saying this is some type of hype thing. Look at the evidence. It's clear as day what all this stuff is about. So with all that being said, like, if you're interested, as always, the call is free. You know, I don't charge for the call. I'm happy to chat with you. I'm happy to talk to you and find out where your head is at. We'll see how we vibe. We'll see how everything works. And it's that link down in the description. Now, I'm super booked up at this point, which is fantastic. Thank you so much for everybody who is currently with it. For that reason, there might be a Boyo team member coming on soon. We'll see what happens. Things are going quite well, so we'll see what happens. We'll see how, if the world ends on December the 21st. But if that's the case, you might hear a strange voice or something like that. That's probably just someone I hired on the old Boyo teams. Don't be worrying about that stuff. But we'll get it down. We'll get a chat. We'll get all that stuff sorted out. And yes, if you're interested, pop down. You can sign up below. And thank you very much for everybody who's been supporting me so far. This channel is just so much fun at this point, because it's just so silly but so juicy at the same time. So I hope you all stay well. I hope your juiciness shines like the stars and like the sun and like a big berry, and I'll talk to you later, people. Stay well. Bye bye.